This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Pentagon says boosting Taiwan's defenses is an urgent task to ward off an invasion by China. Two migrants are back in Mexico as the U.S. reboots a controversial Trump-era program that requires asylum seekers to wait outside American soil. Also coming up, Iran's president tells his Turkish counterpart that regional problems need regional solutions and outside players must keep out. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the United States seems to be ramping up its war of words against China over Taiwan. The U.S. Defense Department says arming the self-governed island is an urgent task. The Pentagon's top official for Asia, Eli Ratner, says providing Taipei with weapons and military services will bolster the island's defenses against Beijing. Ratner also says the U.S. is committed to avoid resorting to force or other forms of coercion that would put Taiwan in harm's way. The remarks are expected to anger China, which considers Taiwan a breakaway province. Under the One China policy, almost all nations recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. We've reached out to political commentator Aina Tengen for comment. He explains what the United States' ulterior motives are in pressuring China over Taiwan.
This policy, really, in terms of Taiwan, has ulterior motives. One, provoke China into some sort of action that would justify everything that the U.S. is saying about China, and saying that it's in essence an aggressive state. The U.S. often uses a ploy where they accuse others of doing what they intend to do. Secondly, by ramping up tensions, they're hoping to get the Taiwanese semiconductor industry to relocate from Taiwan to the United States, quote, for safety reasons, unquote. I don't know that either Taiwan or the businessmen will listen to this. It would, in essence, hollow out Taiwan's economy and give really no reason whatsoever for the U.S. to be interested in Taiwan as an entity. And then finally, there's this... It's just a way of continuing to try to push this narrative that China is somehow evil, repeating on a daily basis unfounded uh, allegations through hearings, through other things, saying that China is doing bad things to its people, when in fact it's one of the few nations that has actually protected its people during the pandemic and also sought to eradicate poverty and bring its people into a better living environment.
Now, the United States has returned the first two migrants to Mexico since restoring a Donald Trump-era immigration program launched to remove asylum seekers from U.S. soil. This comes after the U.S. and Mexico last week agreed to relaunch the controversial scheme known as Migrant Protection Protocols. The program requires migrants to wait in Mexico sometimes for months while their claims are processed in the U.S. President Joe Biden suspended the program after taking office in January this year, but he brought it back following an order by a federal court judge in August. Rights groups say restarting the program could incite violence in border camps. U.S. President Joe Biden prepares to open his so-called Summit for Democracy on Thursday. The event will be held against the backdrop of the racist approach towards minorities in the United States and the humanitarian consequences of America's military adventurism abroad.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy.
No matter how the U.S. glosses over itself, its true face of seeking hegemony under the guise of democracy has long been exposed to the world. The so-called Summit for Democracy will only go down in history as a manipulator and a saboteur of democracy.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down.
I think it's a dangerous game that the U.S. is playing. They're sort of drawing a line of division in the world and creating an us-against-them environment, just as they did with the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit.
In recent times, clearly, the United States is not functioning as a democracy. It is functioning as a plutocracy. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. A plutocracy is a government of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%.
A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
Turning to other news now, in a few hours, Iran and the remaining five signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal will return to the negotiating table in Vienna. Representatives from Iran and the P4 plus one countries are reconvening to resume from where the talks left off less than a week ago. On Friday, the negotiators went back to their capitals for further consultations. Tehran has already proposed two draft documents concerning its nuclear commitments and the removal of sanctions. The European parties say Tehran's demands go beyond the scope of the nuclear deal, but Iranian officials reject that, arguing that the drafts are in compliance with the previously approved texts. The first round of these talks kicked off in April in Vienna with the aim of reviving the nuclear deal and securing the removal of Washington's sanctions against Iran. Now, Iran will soon release a list of American individuals and institutions it is sanctioning over serious breaches of human rights. The move comes in response to Washington's fresh sanctions targeting a number of Iranian individuals and entities. The U.S. has banned them, alleging rights violations. Secretary of Iran's Human Rights Commission, Kazem Gharibabadi, says Washington's move is part of the failed maximum pressure policy that uses sanctions for political gains. He says the U.S. cannot claim to be an advocate of freedom and human rights in Iran for the simple reason that it has jeopardized the lives of Iranians by blocking their access to medicine and medical equipment. He added that the U.S. should be held accountable in the court of public opinion for committing violence against peaceful protesters and police killings of innocent people. Iran's president says challenges in West Asia must be overcome through active participation of regional countries. Ibrahim Raisi says there is no need for external actors to meddle in the region's affairs. Raisi made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He said Iran is eager to cooperate with other countries, including Turkey, in the fight against terrorism. Raisi also touched on bilateral relations, expressing hope that Iran and Turkey will manage to expand economic cooperation in the near future. Erdogan, for his part, said recent diplomatic activities in the region show there's need for regional collaboration. He also stressed the importance of economic and security cooperation between the Islamic Republic and Turkey. Some diplomatic meetings would have been hard to imagine until recently, given the geopolitical situation in West Asia. First, the UAE foreign minister visiting Syria, and then the Emirati top security official traveling to Iran. And add to that, the talks between Saudi Arabia and Iran that have been going on for some time. But what is the significance of these meetings? For one thing, the fresh diplomatic drive shows the failed policies of some of these countries, like the war on Syria. For another, it's indicative of Iran's growing influence in the region, to the dismay of the United States.
Iran is expanding its ties with its neighbors. Iran Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, met with the National Security Advisor of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Tahnoon bin Zayed Al Nahyan, in Tehran. During the meeting, Shamkhani stated that lasting stability and security will be ensured only in the light of constant dialogue and cooperation among countries in the region. Shamkhani noted that relations among regional states should by no means be affected by the interventionist policies of extra-regional powers.
You know, for more than a decade, countries in the region have been trying to change the balance of power in the region in their own favor. And we have seen a lot of conflict, a lot of rivalry between the countries in Western Asia. And after a while, let's say after a decade, they are now realizing that who has the real power on the ground, and they are actually changing the positions right now. So
he also underlined the need for joint efforts in order to end the military and security crises that have beset regional Muslim nations. Shamkhani hoped that Sheikh Tahnoon's visit will mark the beginning of a new chapter of relations and create the grounds for expansion of old ties. Sheikh Tahnoon, for his part, hailed Iran as an important and powerful country in the region with a unique geopolitical position that connects the East to the West, and emphasized that close relations with Tehran constitute a priority in Abu Dhabi's policies.
So, they are realizing right now that the conflict in the region, and this rivalry needs to come to an end, and they cannot fight with each other forever. So the rapprochement, we can say, or let's say the recent connections that we have been made between, for example, UAE and Turkey and Iran, and also the negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, are all in that regard, that they are understanding that they need to change the policies and try to get closer to those countries that they feel foes, enemies, or even rivals.
When Iran's 13th government came into power with President Ebrahim Raisi at the helm, one thing was made clear right from the beginning: Iran would solidify and enhance ties with its neighbors, and that's what has happened, especially when one looks at the talks between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Iran has also one more thing at the forefront of its foreign policy: that the U.S. presence in the region is unnecessary.
The Emirati official later met President Raisi. During the meeting, Raisi said enemies of regional countries are trying to stoke fear among neighbors, adding that relations between Iran and the United Arab Emirates should not be affected by foreign parties. Iranian officials also met with visiting Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad in Tehran to boost bilateral ties. During the meeting, the Syrian foreign minister highlighted the ample opportunities for economic cooperation between Iran and Syria, calling for the increased presence of Iranian public and private companies in the Syrian market. Iran has also held several rounds of talks with Saudi Arabia to restart ties. And back in October, Iran and Turkey signed an agreement to broaden neighborly cooperation on security issues, emphasizing their determination to expand strategic ties and jointly fighting terrorism and trafficking. Obviously, the United States is not happy with the growing regional role of Iran and its allies. Back in October, the UAE's foreign minister visited Syria for the first time in years, prompting the United States to denounce the visit. The U.S. has already failed to isolate Iran through sanctions and threats.
The United States has left Afghanistan recently, and it has no other choice but to leave Iraq and the whole region as well. So the Arab countries can understand, if they are wise, they can understand based on some signals. We can realize and understand that they have to some extent realized that they cannot trust and rely upon the Americans.
The so-called U.S. maximum pressure campaign imposed on Iran by former U.S. President Donald Trump did not achieve its intended objectives. Western governments are now seeing the failure of the maximum pressure campaign. Not only has Iran, under Western pressure, become reluctant to pursue further agreements on its missiles and regional role, but it has begun to expand its nuclear capabilities and establish stronger ties with its neighbors. The European trio and the US have also received the message that in the event they do not abide by their commitments, Iran will not tolerate the ignoring of its rights.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Senator David Perdue, encouraged by Donald Trump, is challenging Governor Brian Kemp, a fellow Republican who defied the former president. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Richard Fawcett and Jonathan Martin. The piece is titled Right versus Right versus Left. Governor's race puts Georgia at center of 2022 drama. Former U.S. Senator David Perdue's leap on Monday, 6th of December, into a primary challenge against Governor Brian Kemp, his fellow Republican, ensured that Georgia will be at the hot molten core of the political universe next year, with costly and competitive races that will test the grip of Trumpism over the Republican Party and measure the backlash against President Joe Biden in a state that increasingly reflects the country's demography and its divisions. Already a battleground at the presidential level, Georgia will be the scene of intense Republican primary showdowns for both governor and secretary of state, followed by general election contests in which Democrats, led by Senator Raphael Warnock, who is seeking a full term, and Stacey Abrams, who narrowly lost the 2018 governor's race to Mr. Kemp and announced another bid last week, hope to keep the state a bluer tint of purple. David Perdue, who lost his Senate seat after one term to the Democrat John Ossoff in January, is former President Donald J. Trump's preferred candidate, while Mr. Kemp earned a place on Donald Trump's enemies list after declining to help the former president overturn his 2020 election loss in Georgia. The two will now face off in May of next year in an internecine war that may offer the closest approximation to a referendum on Trumpism next year as any in the country. "Look, I like Brian. This isn't personal," David Perdue said on Monday in a video announcing his candidacy, but he implied that Brian Kemp had damaged his standing with Georgia's Trumpist base of Republican voters. "He has failed all of us," David Perdue said of Brian Kemp, and cannot win in November. Aides to Mr. Kemp gave Mr. Perdue a blistering reception, revealing the depths of the anger over what they view as his betrayal of a fellow Republican and former political ally. They noted that the governor had actually beaten Stacey Abrams, while David Perdue was, most recently, that most loathsome of nouns in the former president's vocabulary, a loser. And Georgians First, Inc., a pro-Kemp political action committee, released an advertisement reminding voters of David Perdue's stock trades of companies whose business fell under the purview of his Senate committees. While Governor Brian Kemp boasted a proven track record, a campaign spokesman for the governor, Cody Hall, said on Monday, Perdue is best known for ducking debates, padding his stock portfolio during a pandemic, and losing winnable races. Endorsing David Perdue on Monday, former President Donald Trump called Brian Kemp a very weak governor who can't win because the MAGA base, which is enormous, will never vote for him. In entering the governor's race, David Perdue joins a number of other GOP candidates who could form a slate of high-profile Trump loyalists in November. The former football star Herschel Walker, with Donald Trump's encouragement, is seeking the nomination to run against Raphael Warnock. And Representative Jody Heiss is challenging the Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who also rebuffed Donald Trump's entreaties to help overturn his election defeat. Both Herschel Walker and Jody Heiss have parroted Donald Trump's false claim that the election fraud cost him the 2020 presidential race. And David Perdue did not limit his own attack to Brian Kemp. Republicans were disunited in Georgia, he said, and Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger are to blame. The influence of Donald Trump, who has not ruled out another presidential run in 2024, is bound to be felt in other states in midterm races. But Mr. Trump has been particularly fixated on Georgia, a state he lost by fewer than 12,000 votes. He and some of his allies are being investigated by the Fulton County District Attorney's Office for potential criminal violations after reaching out to state officials, including Governor Brian Kemp, and Brad Raffensperger in an effort to change the election results. If David Perdue and Herschel Walker lead the Republican ticket next fall, Georgia voters will be forced to choose between revulsion for Mr. Trump and his incendiary politics, on the one hand, and on the other, dissatisfaction with Joe Biden and unease with the liberal politics that Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock embody. The drama will unfold in a state that, with its gaping divides along the lines of race, class, and region, mirrors the nation and its partisan, polarized, and increasingly poisonous politics. Georgia also reflects broader trends among the two national parties. Democrats are increasingly turning to more diverse candidates, but the candidates are still stepping gingerly, as Stacey Abrams did in her launch video, by trumpeting the idea of one Georgia and seeking to elevate unifying issues that can appeal to diehard liberals and fickle suburbanites alike. Some Democrats fear that Stacey Abrams, a veteran state legislator and voting rights advocate, may face an uphill climb in the governor's race given the challenges confronting the party nationally. An unpopular president, high inflation, COVID-19, and simmering concerns over violent crime and how American history is taught in American schools. But many expressed hope on Monday that the coming fight between Brian Kemp and David Perdue would benefit Stacey Abrams, who's seeking to become the state's first black governor, and other down-ballot Democrats. While David Perdue and Brian Kemp fight each other, Stacey Abrams will be fighting for the people of Georgia, said her campaign manager, Lauren Groh-Walgo, pointing to Stacey Abrams' stances on health coverage, school funding, and COVID-related health policies. For Republicans, Georgia has now become perhaps the most consequential proving ground in the party's Trump wars. Should David Perdue and other Trump-backed candidates lose their primaries, it will raise grave questions about the former president's clout in the Republican Party, as well as his own capacity to compete in a must-win state in 2024. By running, David Perdue and his supporters are effectively sending the message that Donald Trump must be accommodated and his election denialism perpetuated. Mr. Perdue's allies say their case is very simple. Brian Kemp is unelectable next November because a significant number of Trump devotees will stay at home if he's nominated. The bitterness between Brian Kemp and Donald Trump is so deep that Kemp cannot win a general election, said Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker who is backing David Perdue. The question for Georgia Republicans is, would you like Perdue or Stacey Abrams? Because if you're for Brian Kemp, you're effectively voting for Stacey Abrams. For his part, Brian Kemp, who in his 2018 race brandished guns and threatened to round up criminal illegals in his pickup truck, can be expected to remind Republican voters that it is hard to outflank him to the right on issues like gun rights and abortion rights. He also signed into law Georgia's controversial new voting law, which limits ballot access for voters in urban and suburban areas that are home to many Democrats. Brian Kemp's supporters also say they believe that Stacey Abrams is enough of a polarizing force to cauterize any GOP wounds sustained in the primary. She will inspire Republicans to come back out, said Eric Erickson, a Georgia-based conservative writer and radio host. They're not going to stay home in Kemp versus Abrams or Perdue versus Abrams. Still, Mr. Erickson, an outspoken Donald Trump detractor, expressed concern that a nasty primary could disrupt next year's legislative session and deny Brian Kemp any new accomplishments to run on. Democrats are eager to amplify the opposition's discord and to downplay President Biden's unpopularity, which is weighing on the party in Georgia as elsewhere, can barely contain their glee. All that David Perdue is going to be talking about is the election was stolen, said Jennifer Jordan, an Atlanta area state senator running for attorney general. She added, the voters in my district, the Chamber of Commerce Republicans, that is incredibly unseemly to them. You have this guy, Perdue, who had some appeal in the business community and is basically giving that away because now he's just going to become Trump's boy. Andrea Gillespie, an associate professor of political science at Emory University, said she expected Republicans to rally around the party's nominee in November. But even if that were Brian Kemp, she said, Donald Trump could still be a wild card. If Brian Kemp won, she said, would Donald Trump be disciplined enough to keep his mouth shut in a general election?
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I came back to Switzerland to take the bull by the horns and show society what the Swiss bank secrecy really means.
Every trial against Elmer resulted in media coverage on what Swiss banks wanted to keep hidden. The press conference held 2 days before in London brought the international press thronging to Zurich. During the hearing, the prosecutor increased the sentence. She now considered 8 months of prison without parole for Elmer instead of 8 months suspended sentence, as she considered Elmer's new delivery of data to Assange as a provocation to the court.
He said he made many mistakes because he was under pressure. They put him under pressure, in psychological pressure, kind of a mobbing, etc. Elmer never wanted to have money. And quite to the contrary, others, I mean, Kieber in Vaduz or Falciani in Geneva, other cases, They said, I want some millions and I go to the Secret Service. Elmer sent his data to the tax man. I mean, the tax authorities and the papers, the press.
The central issue of the trial is to decide whether the Swiss law on banking secrecy includes data from the Cayman Islands. Two theories abound.
Heidi, what happened yesterday when we left you?
Basically, we drove home and Rudy was having a little nap in the car because he was exhausted after the whole day. And I felt like I was hungry and wanted to have something to eat. And we had a friend with us and we were going into our car subterranean garage.
This arrest had nothing to do with the trial that had taken place the day before. This new judicial investigation was triggered by Elmer's recent handover of data to Julian Assange. Dear David, how is the world treating you and your family? There's not much going on here besides the usual questioning. My health is deteriorating slowly but surely. However, I don't wish to complain. I'll survive as usual. By the way, I won success at the Federal Supreme Court. The prosecutor's office of the state of Zurich now has to investigate the whole issue of harassment by the private detectives. This was a real setback for the Zurich Department of Justice, whose continued decisions to not open an investigation were considered arbitrary by the Supreme Judicial Authority of Switzerland. While Rudolf Elmer was in prison, Bank Julius Baer had some legal issues. The bank agreed to pay a 50 million euro fine to Germany to avoid prosecution for assistance in tax fraud. In the US, the bank was indicted on a conspiracy charge. A New York court accused it of having helped wealthy US taxpayers to hide over $600 million from the tax authorities in Switzerland.
This was the power of the state being used to support fundamentally an illicit, well, let's be blunt about it, an illegal activity, tax evading. But tax evasion is the basis of the Swiss economy. You know, that's what the Swiss banks work on since 1934, when Switzerland put their banking secrecy in place to deliberately help people from other countries evade tax. All the other stories about why they created their banking secrecy are rubbish. They did it to help people evade tax, and they still are.
It's not only a slap in the face of the prosecution office, it's also a slap in the face of the judge who found me guilty in January. And it's a slap in the face as well on the other prosecution office which was responsible for putting me in prison 19th January after the trial.
Rudolf Elmer dropped the harassment charges against the bank and its private detectives in exchange for a sum of around 600,000 Swiss francs. He then placed the money in a trust on the Isle of Man for his daughter in an offshore trust like those he criticizes, but his trust is declared to the Swiss tax authorities.
The Germans already bought another CD. It's an epidemy of stealing data and selling it. That's an epidemy. That's the wrong business model, actually. I sent it directly to the Swiss tax authorities. I didn't ask for money. Maybe I should have. Huh? No. No. We'll be definitely wrong. No.
I'm myself again, which I haven't been for many years. And I do think I helped the society up to a certain extent to make things known. It's also healthy to me being able to get all the secret matters I was carrying around in my brain and trying to hide and not to talk about it out of my system.
Jan Sigler said, Switzerland is the world capital of dealing with stolen goods. Coffee farmers, of course, are very poor people, 26 million of them. And where do you think the coffee profits go to? Switzerland. Mispricing. UBS and Credit Suisse commodity trading. You want to study oil and gas? Switzerland. You want to study gold? Switzerland. You want to study diamonds? Switzerland.
I filed complaints to the prosecution office about Julius Baer, to the federal prosecution office. I filed complaints about journalists down there, to binders for the Köppel case. Then there are two binders for related to the Bilanz Leo Müller case. Then up there, there is one which I took to the federal court. It's another one to the federal court. Considering all the complaints and the challenges I filed with the prosecution office, with the higher court, with the federal courts, so at least 60. I think it is important for me to express that I don't accept the system the way it works. And I do that in writing, and I do that in a way I'm allowed to do. And if I don't take any action, then I do accept the system the way it works.
The Swiss Justice Department continued to pursue Rudolf Elmer. On December the 10th, 2014, a new trial against him began in Zurich. This new case was triggered by his handing over of CDs to Julian Assange in London in 2011. Prosecutors also charged Elmer for sending bank data to WikiLeaks in 2008, a leak that Elmer had admitted to for years without triggering any legal proceedings. This new trial for breach of banking secrecy began even though the first trial, for almost the same reasons, was ongoing. But this time, Rudolf Elmer faced a heavy sentence, 3.5 years in prison.
Psychological warfare. Rudolf Elmer is under psychological warfare operations since years.
The trial of Rudolf Elmer resumed 1 month later, despite advice from his physicians. Elmer received a suspended fine of 45,000 Swiss francs for breach of banking secrecy. He was convicted only for having sent confidential data to WikiLeaks in 2008. Not for the handing over of CDs to Julian Assange in London in 2011, even though this was the reason he spent 6 months behind bars. He appealed the decision. After 10 years of struggle, Rudolf Elmer was exhausted. He had to be hospitalized in a specialist clinic. Has his fight against banking secrecy and the Swiss justice and media been worth the cost? And for what results? The system that he fights, dodges, shifts, and renews itself. After a 3-month rest, Rudolf Elmer is back for a new challenge. His candidate in local elections for the Alternative List, the most left-wing party on the political spectrum. This is the only party to have supported Elmer since his return to Switzerland in 2010.
Could be the beginning of a political career. There are more elections to come soon.
And therefore, yeah, maybe there's a surprise. Let's see. I'm positive about the thing. I enjoy it, actually, because I do think I do. If I return to Switzerland and to get involved in this political field is important, because it's the same thing as with my case, taking the bull by the horns. And if you want to change something, then you have to put your sleeves back and go for it. And that sort of thing I'm doing.
Today we are on a level where it's out of proportion. In simple terms, the taxes which are not paid by those multinationals, financial institutions and high net worth individuals need to be paid by the man in the street. And the man in the street is so much under pressure that he might stand up, and violence is very close, very, very close. So it's better to solve the system now than going through that process.
Since all of this debate of offshore tax havens and automatic exchange of information got started, assets in Switzerland have only increased every month. Why? Because in the real world, people know that if they're attacking Vanuatu and Jersey and all the other little tax havens, the money from those tax havens moves to Switzerland. Last year, the Swiss Bankers Association officially reported 320 billion increase in assets under management. 320 billion of 5.5 trillion Swiss francs. An increase of 6% is a lot. It's a lot.
The people in the Zamora are refugees in their own country, on land that is gradually eroded by the temperamental Brahmaputra River. 160,000 people live on Majuri, who might sooner or later become refugees. The government is quite worried about that.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration is perpetuating Trump's hateful legacy of deterrence and xenophobia, says Oscar Chekhan, writer, in an article titled, Biden is upholding Trump's hateful vision for the border. Stay tuned for more. The immense horrors of the Trump era Remain in Mexico program are well documented. The murder, rape, torturing, and kidnapping of asylum seekers forced to wait for their U.S. immigration court dates in Mexico border towns that rank among the world's most violent. The Biden administration officially ended Remain in Mexico in June, but is now reinstating it under a court order. In one key area, Biden's rebooted Remain in Mexico is even more cruel, expanding the number of people who can be placed into the program, including Haitians and other Caribbean nations with majority Afro-descendant populations like Jamaica. There was nothing in the court order that compelled this. This is deliberately stepping beyond what the courts are asking for. In order to subject black and brown asylum seekers to greater misery and supposedly deter them from fleeing. In the face of deep evidence that deterrence-based immigration policies don't work. coupled with the administration's recent decision to extend Title 42, the end result is that Trump's hateful vision of U.S. immigration policy lives on under Biden, a complete and ongoing shutdown of asylum at the southern border. The Biden administration is dragging its heels and refusing to fully and swiftly do away with Trumpian border policies because they are terrified of the political cost of images of disorder and suffering at the border. Immigrants, asylum seekers, and refugees have been a blessing to the United States. But Biden isn't implementing policies that reflect this reality. For the sake of political expediency, instead, we are meting out punishment to those who need our compassion. Those experiencing the disproportionate impact of these policies of punishment over the past few decades have been nationals from Mexico, Central American, and Caribbean nations. In other words, black and brown people. The majority of individuals enduring the brunt of these policies are people seeking protection at the border. As Biden continues to uphold illegal Trumpian policies that shift the U.S. government's asylum responsibilities to Mexico, the implicit intent seems to be to keep asylum seekers who are people of color out of sight and out of mind. This is reprehensible. Indeed, the resumption of Remain in Mexico contributes to long-lasting damage to asylum norms. At a time of mass migration throughout the Americas due to climate change disasters and the economic impact of COVID-19, the Biden administration is moving to normalize the existence of miserable refugee camps and overflowing shelters along the U.S.-Mexico border. Well-resourced countries like the U.S. should be upholding international humanitarian protection standards, not passing off asylum seekers to its neighbors. For an administration that promised to oppose policies enacted under Trump, it is ironic to contrast the speed with which the Biden government arrested and deported thousands of Haitians who arrived recently to U.S. southern border, with the incredibly slow pace and seeming ineptitude with which officials have dealt with the still unresolved cases of immigrant children who were separated from their parents. For those who advocate for the right of people to seek humanitarian protection at U.S. borders and elsewhere, it is becoming increasingly clear that the racist and xenophobic arguments that paint today's immigrants as a threat to the U.S. have found an echo in the way the Biden administration is treating people who have been forced to migrate and who are asking the most powerful nation on earth for protection and support. It is not too late to right the wrongs. The Biden administration should vigorously contest the court ruling that ordered the re-implementation of Remain in Mexico program. Additionally, the administration could immediately designate nationals from Guatemalans, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, and Hondurans already living in the U.S. for a new temporary protected status TPS program. That measure would protect them from being deported back to a region still reeling from the effects of last year's hurricanes. The administration could express unequivocal support for the migration provisions in the Build Back Better bill, which would establish work permits, protections against deportation, and ability to travel outside the U.S. for an estimated 7.1 million people. And it could also prioritize working with Congress on the adoption of even more changes to the obsolete racist and xenophobic immigration law now in effect, which, among other things, would enable undocumented immigrants to apply for legal permanent residency visas. The United States has long benefited from the energy, entrepreneurship, and hard work of immigrants and asylum seekers. It is shameful that instead of going down this path, the Biden administration is perpetuating Trump's hateful legacy of deterrence and xenophobia.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.